This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now is Peter Williams, because Peter, we wanted to catch up around sort of the Olympics and what's been going on and things in the wider sphere. So with the Olympics, faster, higher, stronger together, is it still a thing?
Oh, yes, it's been going for a very long time now, since 1896, the modern Olympic movement started, and it is still very much a thing. I've been to the Olympic Games, I think, six or seven times, including Winter Olympics once, and it is still, in my mind, the greatest gathering of humanity in any one place, at any one time, every 4 years, and it is fantastic in that respect. It is just a pity that sometimes the integrity, in fact, way too often really, the integrity of sports administration does not live up to the great Olympic community, which is created by athletes, by officials, and by spectators who come together to watch athletic endeavor. And that to me is the saddest thing, because it is a great gathering of humanity. It goes to show that there can be peace on earth if everybody is together. But unfortunately, there are always some who want to push the barrow, and these Olympic Games have just had too many occasions of people pushing the barrow, and therefore some ludicrous controversies have arisen right from the opening ceremony.
Indeed. Will you start with the opening ceremony? I mean, we've already talked about it a lot in other platforms, but that to me didn't embody, it didn't matter how they tried to over-explain it. At the end of the day, if the general public perceive it one way, even if the organizer says that no, this is the Greek feast of Dionysus, whereas a third of the world's Christians are like, no, you riffed off the Last Supper and we don't like it. It looks like a dog, smells like a dog, barks like a dog. It was a dog.
Yeah, absolutely. The funny thing is, Marie, I was in New York on that Friday, the day that the Olympics opened. And the opening ceremony was on at what, 2 p.m. New York time, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. New York time. I was doing other stuff, didn't see it live, therefore watched the replay at, 7 o'clock that night. NBC is the host broadcaster, had a bit of sort of preamble, usual theatrical stuff in the lead up to the opening ceremony, with a bit of Snoop Dogg and a bit of Kelly Clarkson and all these, you know, important athletes of the past, unquote. And then they cut straight to the parade of the athletes. So the whole, theatre of the opening ceremony was not broadcast, not rebroadcast in prime time by NBC at all, which suggests that maybe NBC editorial executives had said, ooh, this is all a bit hot to handle. We're not going to show this in prime time, so they didn't. So like I say, we had the bit of singing and dancing and some nice graphics for about 20 minutes, and then it was straight to the parade of athletes or the regatta, the flotilla down the Seine. So all that Last Supper stuff I didn't know about until I read it on social media and read it in a few other articles about the controversy that had arisen.
Such insanity. Mm. And then, of course, the half-hearted apology by the Olympic Committee on it, which really was, if you have been offended, then we're sorry. Like, no sorry for we put this on. If you happen to have been offended, it was like the apology. It's like soz, not soz. That's not an apology. Anyhow, moving on.
Well, it's just typical of the world at the moment. If you're a Christian, you're an endangered species, aren't you? And you don't really matter.
Mm. And I think Rachel summed it up beautifully when you were talking with Marty last week, was, if they had mocked Islam, Paris would still be burning.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. Mm.
So then the next other controversy that has really actually captured many people and really fired up both the world of the internet and the media has been around these two boxers, the Taiwanese boxer and the Algerian boxer, who have now the new term, and I keep up with these gender terms, Peter, but apparently intersex is now no longer a thing. It's DSD. DSD is our new term for these boxers. I mean, this isn't unprecedented at the Olympics. I mean, Caster Semenya falls into this category. But of course, Caster Semenya was stopped from competing.
Well, she's been effectively thrown out of her sport because of the way that she was born. She was thrown out of her sport by World Athletics, led by Lord Sebastian Coe, and that happened, I think it was 2019 or 2020. And at the time, I was very much in disagreement with that decision because I took the attitude that Caster Semenya cannot help the way that she was born. She is androgynous, intersex, DSD, which stands for dysfunctional sexual development. So that is a thing of nature. That was the way she was born. She has undescended testes. She has very high levels of testosterone. She is, in effect, a male in all but the appendages that she carries. But she was identified as a female at birth. She carries female on her passport. She has lived a life as a girl. And that's exactly the same with these two boxers. The difference between Caster Semenya and the boxers is that Caster Semenya in her sport was not physically endangering her fellow competitors. In fact, there was a suggestion at one stage that many of the other athletes in Caster Semenya's event, that is the 800 meters, may well have had the same condition as her. And it's just that she was faster and stronger than them and therefore won the two Olympic gold medals and the three world championships. But, you know, Marie, this business of intersex or androgynous or DSD or whatever is, it seems, not a new phenomenon. We can go back, of all things, to 1932. Have you ever heard of a woman called Stella Walsh?
No.
So Stella Walsh was born in Poland. At birth was given the name Stanisława Waleskiewicz, went with her parents to America at 3 months of age, was raised as a girl, as a woman, was a great athlete, became an Olympic athlete in 1932 at the Games in Los Angeles, won the 100 meters, went to Berlin in 1936 and got a silver medal in the 100 meters, fated, and by the way, representing Poland, because she was never given American citizenship for reasons of discrimination. That's the way America was in those days. They weren't very keen on immigrants from Poland. So she represented Poland on both occasions, but effectively lived in the United States the whole time. The great irony that I'll tell you before I tell you the sort of the punchline to the story is that in 1936, when she got a silver medal, she and the Polish delegation questioned whether or not the winner of the event, a woman called Helen Stevens, was in fact a man. So a sex test was undertaken on Helen Stevens, and it was found that she was, yes, a genuine, bona fide woman. So fast forward from 1936 to 1980, and Stella Walsh, or Stanisława Waleskiewicz, as she was known at birth, but Stella Walsh, as she was living back in Cleveland, Ohio, was very sadly and very unfortunately a victim in a drive-by robbery at a shopping mall in Cleveland, and she was shot dead. And they did an autopsy. And this is the woman who had won two Olympic medals. When they did the autopsy, they found things that were very strange. And it was then discovered that she too was intersex with the undescended testes. And even though they couldn't measure testosterone when she was dead, it was then deemed that she also had been effectively a man in a woman's body. So therefore, we go all the way back to the 1930s to find this controversy happening at the Olympic Games, although, of course, it was not discovered for another, 45 years after that. Then in the 1960s, you may remember a woman by the name of Tamara Press, who was a shot putter and discus thrower from the Soviet Union. And she was always thought to be a bit odd in terms of her build. She won Olympic gold medals, world champion, no, not world championships because they didn't have them in those days, but certainly Olympic and European titles in the shot put and discus. There was much controversy around Tamara Press in the 1960s. So under a bit of pressure from fans and from athletic authorities, the Olympic Committee, the IOC, introduced sex testing for female athletes, for all female athletes, from the 1968 games in Mexico onwards.
Was that the cheek swab that they talk about?
Yeah, I think that's what they were doing. That's how they did it. When news of the sex testing came to light with the athletes, mysteriously, coincidentally, Tamara Press, who was still in the prime of her career, retired.
Mm.
And the sad thing is, from a New Zealand perspective, is that Valerie Young and Valerie Sloper, who was our preeminent field athlete in the 1960s, finished fourth in Olympic events twice that Tamara Press won. So you could say that a great New Zealand athlete, Valerie Young, Valerie Sloper, was denied an Olympic medal because of this intersex woman that she was competing against. But that's all history. So what I'm saying, Marie, is that this business of women with male characteristics is not a new issue, but sadly it's come to light in 2024 at a time when there is far more scientific information and far more media information known about the issue. And we've got some great stuff which has come to light just in the last few days about Iman Khalif and about Lin Yuting of Taiwan, the two boxers who have tested with the XY chromosomes. And the IOC are well aware of the testing that has been done. It would appear on the surface to be very legitimate. They have acknowledged the correspondence from the International Boxing Association about this matter after tests in both 2022 and in 2023. Yet they appear to not do anything about it because, A, they don't like the International Boxing Association, the IBA, and B, because, well, they're just a little woke and the Olympic Games should be all about inclusiveness and everybody should be able to take part no matter their physical characteristics because it's all about fairness, inclusivity, and diversity. Unfortunately, it might not always be about athlete safety, where the bottom line's got to be drawn.
So then in your opinion, in this context, what is a woman?
Well, a woman surely is one with testosterone levels below 5 nanomoles per liter of blood, which is the normal range for a woman. Marie, you may or may not know this, but your testosterone level is probably between 0.5 and 4.5 nanomoles of testosterone per liter of blood. Myself, I've never had mine tested, but I'm likely to have a level of testosterone somewhere between 10 and 35. In other words, I have way more testosterone than you, and I am theoretically, without us going to the gym and pumping iron to perhaps change this, I am likely to be physically stronger than you because I'm a man and you're a woman. Mm. And that is just one of those things in nature that nobody can do much about because that's just the way that the male of the species and the female of the species is born. So when it comes to athletics, there is a huge advantage for those who look female but have high levels of testosterone. So look, it is a very complicated, and I hate to use that weasel word that politicians use all the time, complex issue, but I'm afraid that in this case it is. It would appear that, and forget what the passport says, that's absolutely irrelevant because anybody can have whatever gender they want on their passport, all they've got to do is fill in the form. It would appear as if there is this small percentage of the world's population, somewhere between 0.5 and 1% of the world's population who are born DSD, with dysfunctional sexual development. And when they look female and are raised as female but have male internal bodies and male internal substances or levels of male internal substances, then they're going to have a huge advantage in an athletic or sporting event where strength and speed is the key thing.
Surely just going back, though, to the cheek swab and taking it back to a genetic level would fix all of that.
Well, a bit of common sense would occur, and World Athletics decided that they would do that in the matter of Caster Semenya. And I think there's about another dozen athletes who had been competing as women who fell into the same the same category as Caster Semenya in that they had elevated levels of testosterone. World Athletics offered those athletes the chance to take some drugs to reduce their levels of testosterone. Now, I'm sorry, but I just don't think that is a very healthy thing to do. And Caster Semenya herself said, I'm not doing that. This is the way I was born. I'm not going to change the way I was born because I'm not going to medically change my internal systems. Who knows what side effects could occur as a result of that. So Semenya effectively has been chucked out of athletics, which is a great shame because she was one of the all-time greats, in my opinion. She was a magnificent sight to watch in full flight, winning those 800-meter titles. But she's gone. She's now coaching in South Africa. But World Athletics effectively have thrown her out. But I come back to the key thing when it comes to the field of play. She did not physically hurt any of her fellow competitors. She may have mentally hurt them because she just was way too good for them, and they might have thought, oh, blimey, we'll never, ever be able to compete with her. And in actual fact, they probably won't or would never have been able to compete with her. But boxing is different because boxing is a contact sport. It is a sport where the idea is to hurt your opponent. And when you have somebody effectively who is a male, albeit somebody who has been born and looks like a female and raised as a female and has acted like a female but has never menstruated and never done any of the usual female things growing up, then that athlete has a tremendous advantage. And that's the way it's proved so far with these two, with Iman Khalif. In fact, only in the last few minutes before we recorded this interview, Marie, I watched Iman Khalif in her semi-final of the welterweight division against a poor little woman from Thailand who was completely overpowered. It was a unanimous points decision. The woman from Thailand did well to last the three-minute rounds. But Khalif was never going to lose, so she now fights for a gold medal, and I'm sure she will win that gold medal in a couple of days' time. The other athlete we're talking about here, Lin Yuting from Taiwan, has her semi-final Thursday morning New Zealand time, and I have no doubt that she also will win and that both of these DSD athletes will go on and win gold medals. So the controversy will not go away because they're still in high-profile positions throughout these games. They'll be on the top of the podium. Their national anthems will be played and their country's flags will be raised. One other thing I should point out, Marie, is that having watched this fight this morning on TV, the commentators don't want to know about this issue. All they'll say about Iman Khalif during her bout with the woman from Thailand is that, oh, she's got tremendous support from all the Algerian fans. You could hear some booing in the crowd. You could also hear a lot of cheering. And the only teensy-weensy possible reference to this crazy controversy swirling around Olympic boxing is that the commentators said she's had to go through a lot. Put up with a lot, or words to that effect.
So
basically
agree.
The commentators will just not buy into this this controversy. And, of course, they will be under those commentators – having been in this position myself, they will be under severe instructions from their employers at the Olympic Broadcasting Service to not mention it at all, not say a thing, because we just want to sweep everything under the carpet.
I mean, I have a degree of sympathy for the athletes, both those athletes. Because
both athletes,
know,
of course, yeah. They can't
this is
the way they were born.
Yeah, and I think in the debate in this, I think people forget, like, there's been a lot of focus on them, and it's actually, no, you shouldn't be focusing on them. It's bureaucrats you should be focusing on.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This isn't their issue. This is a bureaucratic issue, and it will be interesting to see how it unfolds and if anything changes at all. I mean, you know, we had, and I think the one reason this has been highlighted so much is A, this is a contact sport, and B, there are medals that'll come out of this, and there have been people hurt, you know. So it will be intriguing to see how it plays out, and probably by the time this goes to air, we will know. So, yeah.
I see that the IBA, by the way, the International Boxing Association, mm-hmm. which in itself is in a major scrap with the IOC because of past history. And to be fair, the IOC has a point. The International Boxing Association, led by Russians, has been involved in numerous controversies about judging and drugs and various other corrupt activities. But they've put out a very strong press release just in the last 12 hours or so, which outlines their communications with the IOC regarding these two boxes. So they were both tested, and they've even gone so far as to name the laboratories. Firstly, in May of 2022, the Sistem Tip Laboratory from Istanbul, they even put the license number for the laboratory in the release. So they issued a report on the 24th of May 2022, after the competition ended. These are the World Championships of that year. The laboratory detected results that didn't match the eligibility criteria for IBA women's events. So that was in 2022. The IBA, being the fair organization under new management at that stage that it was, said, well, okay, that's just one test. There might be an outlier. The following year, more world championships, this time in New Delhi. Khalif and Lynn were tested following their consent before their first fights. Blood sample collection was made on the 17th of March 2023. Dr. Lal Pathlabs from New Delhi issued its report on the 23rd of March 2023. The findings were absolutely identical to the first test results. The IOC was advised by the International Boxing Association that those tests had been taken. The athletes were given the chance to appeal their disqualifications to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. One of them didn't, the other one started proceedings and then withdrew. So therefore, the decisions were deemed as binding. So the IOC has been well aware of the tests. They've been advised of the labs that did the tests. They were absolutely in the loop, but they didn't do anything about it. So I blame everything on the IOC here. They could have said, sorry, it is not fair that you are allowed to compete. Your international federation says that you are not eligible, as indeed World Athletics have said to Caster Semenya, you are not eligible. The IOC didn't question that, but because they're having this fight with the International Boxing Association, they've decided that they're going to override the decision that has been made by the IBA. And again, it comes back to the politics of world amateur boxing. As we know, boxing, frankly, has, well, it's got a it's got a questionable administrative structure all over the world, really, hasn't it? I mean, look at the number of professional bodies that claim to have world titles. So yeah, it's a sport that has never been united in its administration, put it that way.
Couple of other little things cropping up with the Olympics, and I guess you can comment on this, having been to so many yourselves. There's always criticism of something that goes on in the Olympic Village in one form or another. And in this particular Olympics, had it been the cardboard beds have come back up again in terms of they're very uncomfortable. I've seen athletes who have chosen to sleep outside because it's so hot within the village that it's actually cooler to sleep outside in the village grounds than what it is to sleep in a dorm. And then, of course, the food, in order to reduce the carbon footprint, there is a very high vegan content in terms of the food. What are your thoughts on all of these, Peter?
Nonsense, I think, is the best word to describe it. The funny thing is, Marie, you know, that all the Olympic Games that I went to, one of the very first stories that was always reported about the Olympic Village, you know, before the opening ceremony was ever held, was the number of condoms that were going to be distributed to the athletes during the Olympic Games. And that was always a, you know, a story of with great mirth that here you've got 10,000 athletes from 200 countries from all over the world, and they're going to be shagging themselves silly as well as trying to win Olympic gold medals. So there were lots and lots of, you know, literally thousands of condoms being distributed. Never heard that story this time, but I did hear about the cardboard beds. And then it occurred to me, well, maybe one is not completely unrelated to the other, because you issue the condoms and would the cardboard beds survive after that? As far as the vegan food's concerned, that's extraordinary to me. Absolutely extraordinary, because not only is it no meat, it's no egg. So where the hell are the athletes supposed to get their protein from?
Apparently, the Australian sport kilos and kilos of tuna.
The
bombs
of the Aussies brought in their own food, so good for them. Yeah. But it's just ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, you can take sustainability so far, but frankly, people need to eat and people need to be properly fueled if they're going to be performing at the height of their athletic capability.
Mm. There's also been a couple of unexpected heroes from the Olympics so far. For me personally, I was absolutely delighted to see Novak Djokovic win Olympic gold. So for me, I was very happy about that.
And I agree with you. And the fact that he beat Carlos Alcaraz, who had beaten him in the Wimbledon final only, a month or so ago, it just goes to show the great competitiveness that this man maintains. It may well be his last great tennis victory. And if it is, what a way to go out. What, his fifth attempt at trying to win a singles gold medal? So, yeah, just fantastic.
Oh, and it also thumbs his nose too at that infamous BBC interview several years ago, you know, when he, you know, with all the controversy, when he chose not to be vaccinated and they said, well, why are you doing this? You could have been the greatest. Well, I think he's just proven his comeback and he said he is the greatest. So that for me is been a huge thing. The other one, of course, who has set the internet alight has been the Turkish shooter, Yusuf Dikic. And he, of course, is this 52-year-old man who took up shooting after his divorce, very casually wandered along with a minimum of equipment, hand on his hip or in his pocket, and sort of cocked his eye as if he was just popping out shoot bottles in the backyard. And he comes away with a silver medal. Do you think he's become such a sensation because he's the complete antithesis of all the ridiculousness and the wokeness that we saw at the beginning?
Yeah, and the other thing is that apparently after he'd fired his shots and was waiting for his next round or his next series of shots, he said, where's the smoking area? So in the midst of, 10,000 of the world's fittest people, here's a Turkish shooter without earmuffs, but apparently he did have the plugs in his ears to reduce the impact of the noise. He was out looking for a place that he could have a quiet fag to calm his nerves before the next round. So good for him. Yeah, no, I guess it's just the way it is. Some people are pretty casual in the way they go about their sport. He was obviously very low-key, doesn't get too churned up about hyping up the crowd beforehand. Compare him even to our latest sporting hero, Finn Butcher. I noticed that when he was in the starting gate before his final last night, his name is announced and he's waving his arms and asking the crowd to get all G'd up to support him as well. So, yeah, there are different ways that people like to compete. Some get all hyped. Others are just very low key. And I thought the Turkish boxer was pretty cool, particularly even the way he dressed, didn't sort of put on a special team uniform, just a scruffy old T-shirt, and just go out onto the range and pop off a few shots and, gee, win a silver medal.
Yeah. So there is still some things, I think, within the Olympics to get us excited and enjoy. And, I mean, the other one I caught was the young American pommel horse competitor who was the last to compete in the team's competition. Of course, they've had a drought, since 08, I think, since they won a team medal. Yeah. And he had, just knowing eye stuff as I do, he's very bad strabismus, so he's sort of out there literally getting the feel of the pommel horse before he got started. And just seeing him complete that routine, he knew he nailed it. And he had his arm in the air, but then there was this glance where he looked to his teammates because he was like, oh, maybe I have because I can't see. I can't see it's normal. So let's look at my mates, and his mates are losing it. That was like, okay, this is what the Olympics is about. For me, that cleansed the purge from the opening ceremony. So I was like, all right, we're back on track.
Indeed. And the other thing that has occurred to me in the last couple of days, Marie, particularly when this climbing competition has been underway, is the difference in competition duration across various sports. Now, the road cycling race goes on for, 4 hours, 5 hours? And that is humongous drain on your physical resource to be on your bike for that length of time, and you've got to sprint and you've got to cover the brakes and all that sort of thing. It is a massive test of endurance. So that goes on for the best part of 5 hours. the climbers, the New Zealand climber in action last night, he was on his field of play for under 5 seconds. Now, admittedly, he's got to do it a couple more times, but all up, if he gets to the final, his total amount of competition might be, what, 25 seconds?
I know.
Over five races. So, yeah, just a remarkable contrast in the amount of time that some people have to spend on their field of play.
Now, before we disappear, you've just been to the US for a visit, and I just wanted to get some of your thoughts in terms of what's the feeling on the ground there, you know, heading into the election, obviously the assassination attempt on Trump, and then Kamala, and I see she's announced literally the most inoffensive vice presidential candidate that she could find. I didn't believe that she could manage to find somebody who had very progressive politics but be completely inoffensive and might actually woo back those central Democratic voters, but she managed. She found them. What was the vibe? Get Dennis DeNuto on me, Peter. What was the vibe of the thing when you were there?
Well, I was only in the States for a week. I was in the UK for 3 weeks and watched the coverage of Trump's assassination attempt in Aberdeen, of all places. The thing about Trump's assassination attempt was the coverage of it. And I think many people commented at the time that it wasn't the headline of, you know, assassination attempt on Donald Trump. It was Trump ducks for cover as shots fired. I mean, really? Or the rally cleared, spectators cleared after shots fired at Trump rally. So it was almost as if they were trying to cover up the fact that there had been a shooting attempt, which I found quite staggering. When I was in the States, I picked the worst possible day to go to Washington, D.C. for a day, put it that way, because it was the day that Benjamin Netanyahu was in town. I've never seen so many police and heard so many sirens in all my life. The response I have from people talking to Americans is that the election is going to be close, but those that I talked to were of the same demographic as me, I suppose, male, pale and stale, although there were some females pale and stale as well. They seem to think that Trump will just get home. I see that the polls in recent times are saying the opposite. I'd be appalled if Kamala Harris became the president of the United States, frankly. But I think Trump is the best of a bad lot. I think probably like you, Marie, if I lived in the States and if I could vote, I'd be voting for Robert Kennedy. But the Kennedy campaign just has no profile at all. And that is the thing you do notice about it. It's always struggled for coverage anyway. He started off, remember, as trying to get the Democratic nomination. That was completely overrun, and therefore he went independent. Now, I presume he is still standing as an independent, but you would not know. He is not getting any airtime at all. He is having to revert for coverage to essentially doing his own stuff online, but he's certainly not getting any broadcast coverage, which I think is actually an affront to democracy. The guy has been polling, according to some polls, into double figures. So when you're polling at 10 or 12%, surely you deserve some coverage, but he's getting absolutely nothing. He's not somebody who's brought up in conversation at all.
No coverage or no protection up until the assassination attempt.
Yeah.
This is why I wonder, Tim Walz, the VP pick that was just announced, I wondered whether the Democratic campaign have selected him partially to counteract that Kennedy effect, because the progressiveness of their politics has been quite marked and noted by many Democrats. And I know I've spoken to ones in California who are very dyed-in-the-wool Democrats, and one of them even said to me, I'm just having to take some time off politics because they can't bring themselves to go Trump, but they don't like what they've been seeing with Joe Biden. I don't think Kamala Harris fixes that for them, but this VP pick might soften it. I spoke to Ken the other day, and the thoughts that we bounced around, I think Pennsylvania is where it's all going to come down to, because he RFK Jr. isn't on the ballot in all states, but he is on the ballot there. And that is going to be one of those battleground states where the presidency could be won or lost on just one single ballot.
Well, I spent a night staying with some friends in Pennsylvania, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is the most affluent county in the state. To be perfectly honest, we danced around the fireplace for a while talking about politics because I didn't want to offend my hosts, as you don't. But in the end, they admitted that they would vote for Trump just. But you talk about the VP pick, Governor Walz from Minnesota. In many respects, that is trying in some respects to match it with J.D. Vance, isn't it? Because you're looking at a couple of blokes from humble backgrounds. I know that Vance has subsequently become very educated and made himself a lot of money and has, you know, arisen from a decidedly lower middle class upbringing, whereas this man Walz is very much a middle class man, isn't he? In the military, high school teacher, high school football coach. He's sort of your bloke from down the corner. So he's also one that carries, it would appear, very liberal views on a lot of matters, and is obviously pretty keen to tax the bejesus out of everybody because he wants to give free college education and put meals on the table for all the kids at school. Well, I mean, a lot of that happens in the States anyway, but I think you've got to pay for it at the moment, the meals at school. But he wants the free meals at school. But of course, they're being described in the media in this country anyway as free college education and free meals at school. We know they're not free. You've just got to collect more taxes from other people to pay for them. So it's a distribution model that he seems to favour. Let's tax those who make the money and give it to those who don't make as much. So that's left-leaning, that's socialist politics, and it appears that he is very much from that side of the political fence, whereas Mr. Vance is anything but. And I think that J.D. Vance is obviously being regarded as a threat by the Democrats, hence the trawling through all the old videotapes and bringing up comments like his bit about the cat ladies from 3 years ago, when in fact that was completely taken out of context. And I heard a very good interview the other day between J.D. Vance and Megyn Kelly, where he said, all I was saying was that the Democrats are just not pro-family anymore. The thing about the Republicans is that we like to push the concept of the family unit, the nuclear family, you know, mum, dad, and a few kids. That has been proved over centuries to be the best way to have a civilized society. And Vance is saying the Democrats just don't think that way. They believe the government should run the people. And that is, there's a bit of a parallel to this country, really, isn't there, between the right and the left of the political spectrum in terms of the government's role in raising children. And we've seen this ridiculous carry-on in recent times with that march on Parliament by people from Ngāpuhi saying, we've got 827 of our children in state care, and, you know, if you take away that Section 7AA, then it's going to make life terrible for them. Well, my first question is, how the hell have you got 827 of your children in state care? Why didn't you look after them properly in the first place? I mean, isn't that the most logical question to be asking? Nobody in the media, nobody at Ngāpuhi is asking that. It's just, let's have the Treaty of Waitangi brought in to make sure that everybody gets their cultural needs, the hell with their physical and their emotional needs. But let's look after their cultural needs, because those are the most important things, to which I say, bullshit.
One of the, I'm not a journalist, but one of the things I have learned is that as an interviewer, the most important preface to start a question is why. And a lot of them seem to have lost their whys, Peter. The whys seem to have disappeared. Why?
Well, questions are about why, what, and when.
In terms of the cat stuff, I saw the cat stuff too, and I did have a little chuckle because I thought it was rather rich coming from the Democrats, considering they are the people, being a knitter myself, who then started the entire pussy hat phenomenon of 2016. Who can forget the pink pussy hats? So it's kind of like, you know, I think you guys have to wear the pussy thing. You've got to wear it. The cats are yours. And in Kiwi Farm, you'll love the fact that my education representative in Kiwi Farm is now a portly cat called Pussy Marks. So, you know, what can I say? Look, any other thoughts that before we sort of head off? I mean, I just saw Bruce Cottrell's piece in the Herald the other week because he's also just been in the US as well. And he was opining around the identity crisis that's been held by the Greens at the moment, that they seem to have forgotten that they aren't what they say on the tin anymore. And that you don't realise how environmentally and conservation conscious we've become as a nation until you go somewhere like the United States, which just isn't. Did you sort of, what other cultural sort of differences that you got there and you thought, oh, I didn't quite realise we did this more at home until you come somewhere like the US?
Well, I suppose the most obvious thing when it comes to conservation and sustainability is that in both the UK and the US, you hardly see any EVs, hardly any electric vehicles, because America is obviously the world's greatest car-using nation, even though it has some great public transport as well. And we use the trains pretty extensively in both New York and then down to DC. But because there are so many people, there are just literally millions, hundreds of millions of cars on the road. And, you know, when you're sitting in a taxi or just standing at the corner waiting to cross the street, pedestrian crossing in New York City, you look around to see if there's any Teslas or any BYDs or whatever. No. Well, every now and then one flies by, but it's a very rare sighting. The other thing is that when you go into a shop, they always say, would you like a bag? When you do get a bag, it's invariably plastic. It is not a compostable plastic. It is something you don't pay extra for. So in other words, they're still giving out the so-called single-use shopping bags on a regular basis. It was quite good at one stage because I had a toothpaste tube which burst. So I was very pleased to be able to use one of the single-use plastic bags to make sure that the rest of my suitcase wasn't infected with toothpaste. So those are just little cultural things that you do notice. They're more than happy to have the plastic bags in the supermarkets and in all the retail shops. And there just aren't many EVs around on the road.
Yeah. One of the things, just before we go, I thought I'd let you know about, and I'm going to dive into it actually because it annoyed me. So for listeners that don't realise, Peter and I are both ex-AFS returnees, along with Judge Harvey, which we found out a month or so ago, neither of us realised. And my youngest son was showing some interest in wanting to go and study to the United States. So I said to him, well, AFS could be an option for you. I'll see if it's still around. And it is. So we had a look. And I said to my son, well, here it is. You dive in, have a look, do some research and see if this is something you may want to consider. And he came back to me that evening quite upset because there are still, both for the United States and New Zealand, COVID mandates. Would you believe?
Well, to be an AFS student, you have to be vaccinated, do you?
You have to be vaccinated for COVID, yeah.
I know. Well, I know that even, you know, 52 years ago, when I went, Marie, 53 years ago, you had to be vaccinated for smallpox, which even then I think had been eliminated. And you had to have your other childhood vaccinations up to date. But I think we realised the smallpox vaccine might actually work. That might be the only vaccine that's ever worked, to be fair. But certainly with COVID, it's just ludicrous. You still see a few people wandering around in the US with masks on, but then you do here as well, don't you? So it's still a little bit weird the way that some people are still thinking about it. It is not the bubonic plague that we were told it was, of course. And I don't know whether or not the vaccine shots, 4, 5, 6 of them with the boosters, actually have any impact at all on whether or not you get COVID. So I just find that AFS, but it's become a very woke organization. It doesn't surprise me really that they have these mandates. Disappointing, no. But not surprising.
No, I know. I was just sort of like, oh. But anyhow, on that, thank you so much for the catch up today. It's been good to have a look at some of the other elements of the Olympics and see what's going on. I do appreciate it. Just any more writings on our local council? I know that that has been exercising you a little bit. Did you have a nice breakaway, come home and then thought, I need to hit the keyboard?
Well, I wrote a letter to the editor of the Otago Daily Times last night because rates increases at the Otago Regional Council in the last 3 years have been something like 48%, 18%, and 18%. So in other words, year on year, your regional council rates, which admittedly are not high, they're only in the low hundreds of dollars, have just been increasing at a ridiculous rate. The Otago Daily Times yesterday reported that the Otago Regional Council had a surplus of $2 million in the last year. It's got $13 million in cash in the bank, and it's got a managed fund of about $30 million, as well as owning quite a lot of property around Dunedin, and it is the 100% owner of Port Otago, which is a many hundreds of million dollar business. So therefore, the Otago Regional Council has hundreds of millions of dollars of assets. It made an operational profit last year, and as I suggested to the editor of the Otago Daily Times, any future rate increases above the rate of inflation would be an insult to those of us who have to pay it. So I've just put my thoughts out there in writing. Maybe the ODT will publish it, maybe they won't, who knows. But I'm just a little bit annoyed that local authorities, and my local authority is one that I've written about before, it had a $20 million surplus on $87 million worth of revenue, and they're still putting rates up for some people by 30%. I just found that absolutely outrageous. The council effectively has no debt at Central Otago, yet the rates keep on going up and up and up, and I just find that appalling. I just think if you need big capital works to be done, borrow and pay, let the ratepayers pay it off with their interest and principal repayments over the next 30 to 50 years over the life of the asset. That to me makes complete sense. Not stinging ratepayers, outrageous annual rates increases, which are just going to become unsustainable. And central government, frankly, is just being remiss in this matter. They should be getting in there and telling the local authorities to pull their head in.
Well, particularly too, when you're having to pay now for an asset that you may not be able to enjoy in the
That's
future.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, as always, Peter. Take care. And of course, if people miss Peter, you crop up all the time with the Fourth Estate and the political agenda. So good to catch up.
Okay, Marie. Lovely talking to you.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.